To Shattering This. I'm your host, Yana. Our number for those who would like to participate in this discussion is 877-300-7645. Yesterday, in our review of God's creation account, because on the third day, we had God saying that he created plant life, and that we then considered the scientific position of spontaneous generation of life followed by macroevolution from the first form of life, and discovered that it is an absolute impossibility. And scientists know that it's an absolute impossibility. It's kind of like Galileo's issue when he was going up against the Roman Catholic Church, recognizing that the Earth was not the center of the universe. A man may well be, by the way, but certainly the Earth is not. I say man may well be, because if you look at from a scale point of view, the universe seems to retreat inwardly in scale, in terms of diminishment in size, at the same rate and at the same scope that it expands in size and in scale going outward. So as you look at the building blocks of the material world, where you have creatures comprised of cells, and cells comprised of molecules, and molecules comprised of atoms, atoms comprised of electrons, neutrons, and protons, and those things then comprised not so much the electron, but the neutron. And proton comprised of quarks and leptons, and on and on it goes. You find that the universe is retreating in scale and scope at the same rate that it is expanding. And so we may be in the center of the universe in terms of humanity. We certainly are not in the center of the universe in terms of our planet. And that was something that Galileo brought up. So here was Galileo's response to the popular belief that was being pontificated at the time, and it reminds me of what a honest searcher would say of the scientific community in terms of their universal promotion of something they know to be untrue, which is the spontaneous generation of life and its macroevolution. He said, and I quote, "In the questions of science, the authority of 1,000 is not worth the humble reasoning of a single individual." Something to think about. Yesterday, we had transitioned into the fourth day. We had not only read God's initial statement regarding the fourth day, but had considered it from a spiritual perspective. God said, "There shall be lights in the expanse of the heavens to divide day from night, and let them exist as symbols and signs for the appointed meeting places and times, for days and for years." Now, one of the things that when you consider this from a spiritual point of view, you realize that Yahweh created seven Moed Mikre. We're going to devote 3 weeks of programs to them, starting 2 weeks from now, beginning with six programs on Passover, followed by six on Leavened Bread, and five or six on Bukurim. And these dates, these invitations to meet with God, are all called Moed Mikre. And so God is telling us that the sun and the moon help us establish the Moed Mikre. The sun's light reflects on the moon, and the reflected light, when it is renewed on the moon, Kadash, it tells us we're beginning a new month, and God uses the combination of the sun and the moon to tell us what the first month of the year is, which is when barley is receptive, when it is green and responsive, still growing in the first grain plant to bear its fruit in the spring. And that starts the first year, and you count 14 days, two sevens, to Passover, which, of course, would then occur on a full moon. And so God is saying that these the greater and lesser lights are going to make a division between that which is light and darkness, and also are going to help us announce signs, which help us announce the timing of his meetings, his seven Moed Mikre, for days and for years. So that's the spiritual implication here. Now, the thing that socialist secular humanists, those who are opposed to the Torah from an atheistic point of view, will do is they attack the creation account by saying that it says that plants were created on the third day, but the sun was not created until the fourth day. Well, God didn't say that he created plants on the third day. He said that plants were the natural evolution of the energy that he and his guidance, his organization, as he promulgated the Big Bang, that everything that he calculated initially and the energy that he put into the system continued to evolve, continued to develop to the point where on the third day plant life emerged and flourished on this planet. And then he did not say that he created the sun and the moon on the fourth day, which is the argument that atheists will raise and say you can't have plants before the sun. And in fact, the sun existed billions of years before the first plant life. That's not what God said. He did not say here that he created the sun and the moon on the fourth day. He said, there shall be lights in the heavens to divide day from night, and let them exist as symbols and signs. So what happened here on Earth, and we've talked about this briefly before, is that the number of asteroid strikes, the number of volcanoes and such, diminished to the point where the plume of ash and carbon dioxide began to wane somewhat. And then the plants, which were created on the third day, began to convert some of that carbon dioxide into oxygen, and the atmosphere of the Earth went from somewhat opaque, certainly at very best translucent, to transparent, the kind of atmosphere we have today, so that you can see the sun and the moon, and therefore the sun and the moon can now be signs of the Moed, of the meeting times. That's all that God said. It is absolutely consistent with what we have learned from science. In other words, the atheist argument against the Torah's creation account on this point, which is their favorite, is bogus because it is inconsistent with the testimony that God provided. In other words, from a debate point of view, it's a straw man, where the atheist is creating an argument that they then attack, but that the argument has no bearing to the actual testimony. Now, focusing on the scientific aspects of Yahweh's witness on this day, we discover that calibrated to the Creator's clock, calibrated to a timepiece from the vantage point and the perspective of someone at creation, the fourth day dawned around 1.9 billion years ago and closed just around 900 million years in our past. During this period, Yahweh said that the sun, the moon, and the stars became signs, which is to say that they became visible. He did not say that he created the sun, the moon, or the stars on the fourth day, because that occurred on the second day when he established light and had this transition from energy to matter. Disingenuous atheists have consistently rebuked the biblical creation account based upon the false assumption that it claims that the emergence of plant life preceded the creation of the sun, but as I have mentioned to you, that is a straw man, which is a fallacy amongst those skilled in rhetoric. Scientists have recently discovered that during the epoch referenced by the fourth day of creation, the Earth's atmosphere, formerly at best translucent, became transparent. Photosynthesis, occurring in the green vegetation, which shot forth, using Yahweh's testimony, on the third day, produced an oxygen-rich atmosphere, setting the stage for the ultimate emergence of oxygen-dependent animals. We humans, and in fact, animals, are dependent upon oxygen. And that is because it takes so much more energy to operate an animal with a soul or consciousness, the ability to react to the environment around us. And oxygen is a much better catalyst when it comes to producing energy. That's why if you have a fire and you have no oxygen, it will not burn. And if you have a fire and you add a higher percentage of oxygen, it explodes. So God was using plants not only to make our atmosphere transparent, but to produce oxygen, which was needed for the animals that he would later conceive. It took a long time, 3 billion years to be precise, all of the second and third day cosmologically, for plants to produce sufficient oxygen to fuel more complex animal forms. It is why there is no mention of them living at this time. It is why the fossil record shows no existence of animals at this time. Animals, which are a different form of life, life with a soul, life with consciousness, life with the ability to respond and observe their surroundings, would not explode onto the scene until the fifth day, cosmologically speaking. Spiritually speaking, Yahweh had a lot more to say about his Moed Mikre, which was the sun and the moon became signs associated with these Moed, which are the Moed Mikre, the meetings that God has established each year for us to attend. He said, they exist as lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light and for the earth existing and established. God fashioned the two large luminaries, the greater luminary to rule over the day and the lesser luminary to govern the night and the stars. So he is describing the difference between the two. There is a greater luminary. The greater luminary is from Gadol. Greater Gadol means more enormous in magnitude and intensity, mighty, important, distinguished. Gadol is to be magnified, to be great, to be powerful, and to do great things. So he's putting a extraordinarily godly spin on the greater luminary, trying to say that source of light you can equate to my nature. And then he's going to speak of the term for rule, which means to have dominion over, authority over, and to govern. Let's return to Yah's word after the commercial break. Shattering this, we're considering Yahweh's testimony regarding his Moed Mikre and the nature of the greater and the lesser luminaries. He is now presenting the sun as an example of light, of providing light, of being enormous, of being mighty, of being distinguished, of being important. And he is then associating that so that we can learn something from the benefit of light, the illumination that it provides that enables us to be observant, to govern, to have authority over the day, which is being cast in a positive sense. And then he says the lesser luminary to govern the night. The lesser is from Katan, very similar, by the way, to Satan, which is adversary. But Katan means smaller, insignificant, and unimportant. Younger chronology, in chronology, lower in the status, from Kut, which means to loathe, to oppose, to be abhorred, and to be detested, to govern the night. Now, you might wonder, well, why would he call the moon a luminary, and why would he associate this luminary with the abhorrence of Hasatan, Satan? It's because as a spiritual creation, Hasatan, is akin to light. He exists eternally. Even God can't destroy him. Energy cannot be destroyed. He can be incarcerated, and he will be, but he cannot be destroyed. He'll be ultimately thrown into a black hole. But the reality is here that God is trying to set up this contrast between light and darkness, and he is setting up his moed, his meetings, so that we can go from darkness to the light. And that is what he is establishing for us to understand on this day. We'll take a pause here in our presentation of Yah's testimony. We're going to go to Jake, who is calling in from Idaho and wants to pose a question or make a statement regarding the Jewish observations of mixing meats. So I don't know how that has to, what that has to do with today's program, but it's certainly a curiosity for Jake. So, Jake, welcome to the program. Hello, Jake.
Hello, Yada. It's my pleasure to call in again with a really simple question.
Okay.
A little off topic from what we were talking about, but with Pesach coming up here in a month, I'd love to get some clarification on something.
Okay.
Now, I know in the Jewish practice, in the dietary laws, there is a great concern about mixing meat with dairy products. And I was wondering, in planning for meals for our next three mikre, what does Yah actually say about that?
Yeah, God's got no issue against dairy products. His only statement regarding milk and meat is he instructs us not to to boil meat in milk. And so other than that, he's got no issue with milk. Milk's an extraordinarily nourishing food, and he doesn't say anything negative about it. What Jews did, these would be religious Jews, in creating their kosher laws. And it's the kosher laws really form the backbone of Judaism, because they claim that because God did not go about and establishing all of the rules necessary to be kosher, that God was leaving it up to man to establish these rules. And so all of the kosher laws that are followed by Jews are man-made laws that man thought that God had set aside for them to establish. And so they say that the reason we know that there's an oral Torah is because God didn't go into detail establishing lots of rules on what we can and cannot eat. Therefore, he left it to man to do so. And that has become the foundation, if you will, of the Talmud. Now, of course, that argument is stupid. God simply said, here are the things that are good to eat, here are the things that are not good for you to eat, and everything that he said was not good for you to eat, we have learned subsequently there were absolute positive reasons as to why those meats should have been excluded from one's diet. That's all he said. He didn't say that if you eat these things, you're going to go to hell. He didn't say if you eat these things, you're going to be estranged from me. He just said, these are the things that are good for you to eat. Here are the things that are not good for you to eat. The advice was very, very good. The purpose, though, of the Torah isn't to tell us what we should do and what we should not do. There are no laws in the Torah. There are instructions in the Torah. And so when you look at the dietary instructions in the Torah, the purpose of them is for us to learn from them. Yes, they're good advice. Yes, they're practical advice. But the main lesson here is that if you consume things that are bad for you, for example, religion and politics, they're going to poison you. And that's... to Shattering Mist. We're on the phone here with Jake calling in from Idaho. The reason that Jake posed his call was wanting to know if there's any issue with mixing meat and milk from Yah's perspective, since we're moving in towards Passover, which is will be celebrated beginning at sundown on the 26th of March. And I have already recorded 6 hours of programming on Passover, not too long from now. I'm taking a vacation, but so that the program has all new material. The second hour has, and the first hour, the news portion and the second hour have already been pre-recorded and ready to go. Scott's been a big help in that regard, so I can tell you for certain that there are six programs devoted to Passover, which will play here beginning in about 2 weeks. The comment on milk as it relates to meat is, as I had shared with you, Jake, it's presented not once but twice in the Torah. Yahweh speaks of it in the book of Shemoth, names Exodus, and then Moshe affirms it in Dabarim, which means words, Deuteronomy. And the instruction from God is simply, do not boil a kid, which is a young goat, in its mother's milk. Now, as it relates to Passover, God has specifically told us he does not want us to boil the lamb on Passover. He wants it over a fire. He wants it over a fire for lots of reasons, and I went through all of those reasons yesterday, as to all the symbolism of fire, the smoke that rises up to God, the light that it produces so that we can observe his testimony during this time, the warmth that, to gather around as a family, and of course that the Passover lamb, the part that you don't eat, needs to be incinerated that night, as was the case with Yahusha. So this is simply, milk is nourishing to a child, and so the last thing God wants, and that's the instruction in Exodus, don't cook a baby goat in its mother's milk. Everything else that is extrapolated from that by the rabbis has no connection to Yahweh at all.
Adding to that list, too, barbecue tastes so much better.
It does, and one of the advantages of open flame cooking is that the fats are drip off of the meat, where if you boil meat, that the fats of, particularly if it's a fatty cut of meat, and lamb is a fairly fatty cut of meat, they stew in their own fats, and it becomes less healthy than meat which is barbecued. And I happen to be with you. I happen to love grilled lamb. One of my favorite dishes. Fortunately, we're going to have it for all eternity, so I'm glad that I like the taste of it. So that answers your question, Jake?
Absolutely. And it's really remarkable, the contrast of the two things that that you were talking about before my call and this call, in looking at the relationship between our perspective and Yahweh's perspective. He's looking at huge things. He's looking at eternity. He sees he created the world. He created the universe. And his concern, his focus is with his relationship with us. And it's so easy for us to get focused on the minutiae, on does God really care about whether or not we're boiling our goats in their mother's milk, versus focusing on what's important to him, our relationship, and that contrast between those two perspectives was really interesting.
Yeah, it's true that in the opening statements in the Bereshith, in the beginning, Genesis, that God's perspective is broad. He's trying to associate the importance of light and the contrast between light and darkness so that we understand the choice that we're all being given. He's trying to establish the role of his spirit and the role of water in terms of life and of cleansing, because he's going to use the metaphors of life, light and darkness, and of cleansing and the living waters throughout his testimony and the role of his set apart spirit. He's going to constantly address his role in the conception of life and the purpose of life. And he's going to establish a contrast between him leading us into the light and the adversary leading us into the darkness. And so these are all very big picture things. Now, that is not to say that God's testimony to us always remains on the big picture. He very often will speak of details, which when those details are analyzed, help us understand who he is, who we are, and how we can get together and enjoy the covenant relationship. The story, the instruction of boiling a kid in its mother's milk, his instructions on what foods are healthy for us to eat and which are not, are details, but when understood, help illuminate and color the overall tapestry that Yahweh is painting in terms of who he is and how the relationship was conceived for us to engage with him.
Absolutely. That's part of his holding up of his side of the covenant agreement of extending, prolonging our lives in that relationship by providing instructions saying these are good things for you that are healthy and
correct.
Nowadays are scientifically proven to provide a longer lifespan and a healthier life.
Yeah, and that's really the contrast, too, between the things that you mentioned in terms of Jewish rabbinic law and God's Torah. The Torah is not comprised of law. It's comprised of fatherly advice, of guidance and instruction. The fathers tell their children, these things are good for you, these things are not good for you. And the purpose is to help their children grow, to help their children learn, to help their children make better decisions. And when everything in the Torah is viewed from the perspective of instructions and guidance and teaching to benefit us, to help us understand and grow and to make good decisions, then your focus is God's perspective. And when you go to the Jewish religious position, where it is a set of laws that one has to obey, and you augment those laws, then what you've done is corrupted the entire thing, and you've created a lord that wants to have his subjects obey him, which is the antithesis.
Over the minutiae of your lives.
Correct.
Whether
the Christian God is also like that.
Action, yeah.
Yeah, the Christian God is like that. Tim Tebow's God is like that, intervening in every aspect of a life, choosing who wins a football game, whether a pass is completed. And most Americans actually agree with that mentality, that God is involved in every aspect of their lives, and that when bad things happen to them, it was God that did it to teach them a lesson. And when something good happens, it was a blessing from God, and they give him credit. If God was involved in the minutiae of our lives, then he would be a micromanager and he'd make an absolute farce of free will, and then on that basis, the covenant would be a complete joke. And so there is no truth to the notion that God micromanages our lives and gives us blessings and gives us curses. That is not the nature of our Heavenly Father. He is a big picture God. He provided his covenant. He does meet the needs of the children who embrace his covenant, but not by micromanaging the lives and intervening in the lives of everyone to do so.
Mm-hmm. But that's certainly not to say that he doesn't have an influence in that minutia. Through observing the Torah, we learn so much about how to handle those little things that come up.
Well, as a father, he has put his guidance before us. You know, you don't have to go to God and say, how should I handle this situation? What is your will for my life? God has told you what his will for your life is. God has told you, he's given you the insight you need to make good decisions. He has given you the proper perspective to engage in the relationship with him. And so all we need to do is observe what he has given us and respond favorably. Now, once we do that, we're now engaged in a relationship, and that relationship is twofold. If we continue to listen to him, we continue to seek his advice, he will constantly provide it. I mean, I can tell you that every time that I go through any statement that Yah has authored, and I consider it the 15th time or the 16th time, I learn something new that I didn't know the previous time. It's an ongoing relationship. And based upon that learning, I'm in a much better position to live my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's got to be extremely careful, though, too. I mean, he's actually under more constraint than us. Because he doesn't have free will.
Far more.
He doesn't
far
have
more.
Free will.
No.
So, like, he can't micromanage us because then that eliminates our free will, something that he's definitely told us that we have.
Yeah. I'm not sure that God doesn't have free will. I think he has free will. It's just that God cannot contradict himself. He can't say, hey, you can trust and rely upon my Torah instructions and then say, oh, you can ignore my Torah instructions because they were not valid. What I said about them in terms of saving you and being eternal is untrue. I'm now going to create an entirely new concept that is based upon knowing nothing. You're going to accept it by faith, and it's going to be entirely capricious. He can't do that. He can't go, for example, to hell. You know, Allah spends all of his time in hell. God can't go to Sheol because he defines it as the place that is separated from him. So God can't lie. He can't be dishonest. He can't be duplicitous. He can't be capricious. There are lots of constraints on God. God cannot represent darkness. He can't lie. So, yeah, there are, like, all the promises that God made. He says, you know, if you embrace these five terms and conditions of the covenant, I promise that I will respond by giving you these five benefits of the covenant, which are eternal life. We're perfected in God's sight. We're adopted into his family. Then we're enriched with his teaching, his guidance, and we're empowered by his spirit. If we do the five things that he's asked of us, he is absolutely bound to do the five things that he's promised. So you're right, Scott. God has far more restrictions on him than we have on us. We can choose to ignore his testimony. We can choose to corrupt his testimony. We can choose to lie to others. We have the ability to do those things. God does not. So anyway, Jake, thank you so much for the call. We're going to return to our presentation of the fourth day at this time. Well, I guess we're going to do so after the break, but stay with us. There's a lot more to explore as it relates to the nature of this, the fourth day of creation, and what God established as it relates to the contrast between the greater and the lesser luminary and their governing the day versus. Shattering this, I'm having a fun conversation with Scott over the notion of whether or not Yahweh has free will as it relates to his promises. You know, God decided what he wanted, which was to enjoy a family, to establish a covenant family where he, as our father, could empower us, enrich us, help us grow, protect us, just enjoy our company. That's what God wanted to achieve, and so he made promises. The Hebrew Shabbat is based upon the concept of God's promises. He made promises to us, and he, based upon what he wants, and then because of who he is with unlimited power and authority, he has the ability to honor his promises. So then the question is, has God acquiesced his free will in this regard because he has said that he is not going to change, that his promises are dependable, and that anything that he has said we can rely upon, which means that he cannot renege or change or go back on any of his covenant or Torah teachings, instructions, or promises. So did God acquiesce free will in that regard, or is it simply that this is what God wants, and he has the power and authority to deliver on everything that he has promised because it creates what he wants most, which is this covenant relationship. So I'm not really certain that when it comes to God, you can distinguish between can't and doesn't want to. No, God told us what he wants. He has the power and authority to achieve what he wants, and he's told us that if we accept his terms and conditions, that we receive all of the benefits because it delivers what he wants most, which is a relationship with us. Now, that does mean that he can't renege on those promises, but he has no desire, no interest in reneging on those promises. Those promises simply define and enable what he wants. So it is a it's an interesting perspective, and I think it's really quite appropriate to speak of God in these very real terms. You know, how is God constrained? You know, one of the things that God says is that once we are benefit from Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim and are adopted into His family, and then empowered and enriched by His Torah and Spirit, which speaks of the benefits of the first four steps that we walk to God through His Moed, that once this happens, God is no longer aware of any of the things that we've ever done in our lives which are irritating, which are corrupting, which are inappropriate. So there are things that God says that He does not know. Thank goodness that He doesn't know those things. So, you know, God has put a restriction on Himself. He says there's certain things that I don't know. He says that I don't even know those who don't know me, and I don't listen to the prayers of those who don't observe the Torah. There's lots of things that God tells us He doesn't know.
If He did sacrifice some of His free will, it wouldn't be out of character.
No,
he's definitely sacrificed things for on our behalf before.
Yes.
So if He did say, you know, you guys can have free will. This is me. I'm going to be this. I'm going to be that consistent rock that you can build upon.
Right.
And
would be in character, wouldn't it?
It would be completely within character. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that us viewing God with from the perspective of there's lots of things that He cannot do, and He gave us more rights in terms of what we can do than He Himself retained, I think what that does is it establishes the right perspective. Now, God is not only saying, I'm the rock that you can depend on, and you can choose to embrace this, stand up upon this rock, be established upon this rock, and grow with me, or you can choose to reject me. You can even, if you want to, work against me and corrupt my testimony. I'm going to give you more rights than I myself am going to retain, which creates this image of God as our Heavenly Father that wants us to be eye to eye, shoulder to shoulder, arm in arm, striding step by step with Him, standing with Him, engaging with Him, having discussions with Him, you know, exploring the universe to get with Him. He's not trying to set Himself up as, here I am way up here, and here you are way down there, and there ain't no way you're getting up to where I am. You know, you are so remote from me, so incapable compared to me, that you're nothing. God is instead establishing exactly the opposite perspective. That He is the rock we can depend upon. That He is establishing Himself exactly who He is and giving us all of the choice as to whether or not we wish to have a relationship with Him. I'm Yada. This has been Shattering Myths. Back with you tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy of my...